This is The Guardian.
Some breaking news from the United States, where President Joe Biden has said that he is going to stand down from the presidential race and not seek re-election to the White House.
There is this feeling, you know, politicians are all liars. You know, they say one thing and do another. I'm determined to do things differently.
If we fail to act now with seriousness and change the Conservative Party, then things undoubtedly could get worse.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian.
Pippa, I find sometimes it's quite nice to come into Westminster and realise that the biggest story of the day isn't actually here. We get to look at the political chaos happening in another country and think, ah, OK, it's not just here that we have, complete turmoil. In fact, if anything, Britain looks like a relative paragon of orderliness right now compared to what's happening in Washington. You were there a couple of weeks ago for the NATO summit. Did you have a sense then? Obviously, this was post the debate. And I remember talking to you just after you came back. Did you have a sense that Biden was about to step down?
It really felt like there was no other route for him. I was there, as you say, for the NATO summit, but I was also there for the first bilateral meeting between Keir Starmer and Joe Biden at the White House. And at the top of these meetings, as we've talked about on this podcast before, they let the press into the room. So we were there with them for 10 or 15 minutes before we sort of left and left them to the heavy lifting, the serious diplomacy. And during that period in the Oval Office, there was a few things that I really was on the lookout for, because Joe Biden's mental acuity had come under question already at that point because of the debate. And I was very struck by the fact he seemed to be absolutely across foreign policy in really, you know, quite a lot of detail, that he was able to make jokes and not sort of pre-planned one-liners, but sort of in response to comments of journalists coming in the room about the football. England had just won and qualified for the final the night before. And that he looked very relaxed, but that he was quite rambly. I mean, his stories go on a bit. And that he had what I would guess I'd describe as a mid-distance stare, that sort of between comments, he would sort of stare across the room, not sort of fixing on anything, but that sort of really blank look on his face that we saw during the debate. And my conclusion at the end of it all was not necessarily that Joe Biden has some serious condition, but that he's old. And if what I saw in that 10 or 15 minutes I was in the room with him, and then for the next day at that NATO press conference where he mixed up President Zelensky and President Putin, which was, you know, awful. If what I saw in that brief period of time was just a sort of a tiny fraction of what people around him, whether that's his aides, whether that's politicos in Washington, whether that's journalists covering the campaigns, see every day, day in, day out, then it seemed to me that there was not going to be any other route out of it for him.
Yeah, there were two telling moments for me in the last couple of weeks of events in Washington, two interventions that I think stood out. One was George Clooney, the other one was Seth Moulton. Now, George Clooney and Seth Moulton both said versions of the same thing, which is actually this chimes with what we've been seeing. You know, George Clooney had seen him recently at a fundraiser and said, yeah, this had happened there. Seth Moulton, who's been close to him, you know, regards Biden as something of a mentor, said, I saw him recently and I didn't think he recognized who I was. Mm-hmm. You know, when you've got people saying that, it's astonishing that we even thought going into this weekend, he might actually survive this.
Yeah, and what I think it did was confirm for people what they already felt, you know, what they saw at the press conferences, what they saw in the debate. So it felt like there was no coming back for that, really. Even if he then had a perfect, clear record with no gaffes or mix-ups at all, people's minds were already made up. And certainly the feeling on the ground when I was out there was that they were going to give him to the end of the NATO summit because they didn't want to embarrass him on the world stage when he had all these world leaders there. But that the push would come from some quite senior Democrats afterwards. That, of course, was all sort of put on hold by the assassination attempt against Donald Trump. But fast forward a week from that, and then you got reports of not actually the individuals themselves coming out, but reports of everyone from Barack Obama, Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, all saying that they thought that he should reconsider running again. And then lo and behold, over the weekend, we had this huge announcement that he was not going to, he was going to put, as he put it, country and party first, and he wasn't going to stand again in the 2024 race. And crucially, that he would then endorse his own VP, Kamala Harris to be the Democrat candidate.
Yeah, which it seems almost to be as important a decision as his decision to stand down, because suddenly we're in a place where Kamala Harris is the de facto candidate. I mean, it'll take some beating. And from the reports that are coming out overnight, it looks like almost every senior Democrat is saying that they won't throw their hats in the ring. Trying to pass some of what people have been saying at the top level of the Democratic Party has been interesting, because obviously Biden said that he endorsed Harris. Others have said the same thing. Barack Obama tellingly didn't, and talked about having an open process, which will bring forward, you know, an excellent candidate. And that, I think, has been interpreted as him saying, well, let's throw this open. Maybe she isn't our person. I don't know. Maybe it's that. Maybe it's that they want a kind of paper candidate to challenge her, just to kind of show that this wasn't a stitch up in a smoke-filled room. But either way, I just think, you know, if Gretchen Whitmer is not in the race, which we're told she's not going to be, there are other Rust Belt governors who are now being talked about being lined up as potential vice presidential picks. Josh Shapiro of Pennsylvania, foremost among them. Those are the people you thought might challenge her. So it looks like the deal has probably been done.
But also, even if it has been done, I was very struck by her first comments after obviously praising Joe Biden, in which she said that she wanted to earn the nomination. Mm. She wasn't assuming that it's a fait accompli, even if behind closed doors it actually has already been agreed. Because I think that there's a danger for the Democrats of looking like it's yet another establishment stitch-up. And as we all know so well, Donald Trump capitalizes on being the anti-elite candidate. Yeah. I mean, as ironic as that is. And actually, in some ways, it makes his job easier if he can say, look, it's a continuation Democrat. It's a continuation Biden-Harris ticket. She covered up for him, was the sort of the earlier tags. Yeah. But they need to be careful, because there was an internal directive issued in the Trump campaign recently not to push Joe Biden too hard, because actually they felt that constant attacks against him looking old, covering up actually for Donald Trump's own age-related failings. He's had masses of mix-ups himself, and he's, you know, he's not a spring chicken, is he? So they wanted to run against Biden and didn't want to push him too hard. The other thing I think that they'll be conscious of is that they don't want to look complacent, or they mustn't look complacent, because a lot of what we've heard since Joe Biden started having his, you know, since it seriously started being in question whether he would run again, is this sort of certainty coming from the Republicans that they've got it in the bag, and there's nothing that voters like worse than being told that it's already been decided for them.
I think, though, that this is where I think the Democrats might be stumbling into an error, in that there's nothing that party likes more than an establishment stitch-up. Almost every candidate, but apart from Biden himself, who was not, I mean, maybe he was the establishment candidate to a certain extent, but that was quite an open process. But before that, the choice certainly of Hillary Clinton, in fact, one that Joe Biden really didn't like, was seen as a stitch-up by the Obamas. And I think now, again, it's, you know, the Obamas and Pelosi possibly have engineered Biden leaving the stage, maybe having less of an engineered result for who should come next would not be a bad idea for them. I know it's messy. I know that people say, well, you can't have the party fighting itself so close to an election, but you do it quickly. We're about to talk about the Tories in a similar way, but you do it quickly. You can get through that and get a nominee, maybe a less flawed nominee, I would argue.
But I still think that it's most likely that it ends up that Kamala Harris ends up being the Democrat candidate.
Oh, yeah.
So then you need to look at, what does that contest look like?
Yep.
She has the capacity to win back some of the voters that have gone over to Trump, Black voters, Hispanic voters, and young voters who had deserted Biden. She has a problem when it comes to winning the support of some of the Rust Belt parts of the states. And that's where I think her VP choice is going to be really, really important. But also, you know, she was a prosecutor in California who prosecuted sex offenders. And you have Donald Trump, who's made some really inappropriate remarks about women and is a convicted felon, let's not think. So, you know, on the issue of crime, she potentially has quite a strong story to tell. She has, if it's going to be about issues, then obviously she fought and led a very strong campaign on abortion rights, which Donald Trump was on the wrong side of, the Republicans were on the wrong side of, and which has a real electoral resonance in the states in the way that it doesn't here as a one-off issue. And I think that a lot of the framing of this from the Democrats' perspective so far has been pointing it towards Trump, away from Joe Biden's failings and age, and onto what sort of candidate Trump would be. Inevitably now, the limelight is going to be on whoever the candidate, the Democrat candidate is, Kamala Harris most likely. So they're going to have to, I think, work quite quickly and carefully to get beyond the first 2 years of her time as vice president, which weren't massively successful. She was put in charge of the Mexico-US border security, and there was real problems on that. The Biden administration, people around him, let it be known that they weren't very impressed by her. And then there's some sort of internal issues with her staffing. She had very high turnover of staff. People in Washington say that she has got to grips with all of those things now and that the last 2 years have been better. But they need to get that message out there to the American public.
Yeah, well, there's suddenly an incentive for all Democrats to say that things have got better in the last couple of years. So I'm not surprised that the briefings seem to have changed. I wonder as well, do you think that if it is, presuming it is going to be Kamala Harris, how much does the Labour Party here now have to worry about getting contacts within her camp? Because this is not something they've been thinking about for the last few weeks.
No, and it would be harder, but it's not as straightforward as the Biden administration, which they have got very close established links already, notably with David Lammy, the Foreign Secretary, but all sorts of other people within the Labour movement as well. And they don't have those close links with Kamala Harris. What they do have, though, is lots of very well-connected people in Washington, or here and in Washington, and the door is open between the Democrats and the Labour Party. So I think that while they will need to catch up, I don't see it as being a particular problem long term. What I think is really interesting over the last week or so is the way that Labour has reached out even more to the Republicans. And we saw that just after the assassination attempt of Trump, when we're told that Keir Starmer was advised to write a note to Trump and instead said, no, I want a phone call. And that the Trump team were pretty receptive to that. And they actually had sort of a 10-15 minute chat for the first time. So that's obviously a much more complex relationship for them than the Kamala Harris, Keir Starmer one would be. But given what the electoral map is looking like in the states at the moment, it's one that they rightly need to focus a lot of energy and attention to.
Well, you'd think Keir Starmer could phone Kamala Harris and say, hey, look, we're both former prosecutors. We've got a lot of... They're about the same age, aren't they, as well? So they should, in theory, have a lot in common. So talking about Starmer, he obviously has other things that he's trying to do domestically. He's probably largely trying to stay out of the US political situation because there's still quite a lot he has to deal with here. Quite an interesting poll for The Observer over the weekend showing a 20-point rise in his net approval rating. So he's gone from -1 to 19%. That, I think, is the same roughly as Boris Johnson was at the height of the vaccine bounce. He is having a honeymoon. We thought he might not, but he's getting, you know, he's got a couple of weeks of one, if nothing else.
He's been gifted one by Rishi Sunak, though, hasn't he? Because in his first 2 weeks, he's had these big two international events, both the NATO summit and the chance to get his picture taken with Joe Biden in the Oval Office, but also the European political community, which you were at the end of last week at Blenheim Palace, where there was more than 40 European leaders. Again, he had those all-important pictures, that FaceTime, it was quite an informal summit, the chance to sort of remind the rest of the world or introduce himself to the rest of the world, which would not otherwise have happened. There's also been, obviously, domestic issues, which were, you know, we talked about Sue Gray's so-called shit list in recent editions. So there's some really heavyweight, very pressing, very urgent issues that the Labour government came in and had to address. And first and foremost amongst them, of course, was the prisons crisis, huge overcrowding, and the requirement to release early certain categories of prisoners in order to try and sort of release some of that pressure. But even though potentially that could have ended up with terrible headlines, it hasn't. I think because we knew about it before the election, whoever ended up in power was going to have to make a similar decision. They sort of pulled all the other levers that they could. So even something that is complex and difficult, potentially go down very badly with the public, as that seems not to have dented those approval ratings. But of course, prisons isn't the only thing on that list.
No, so he's got to make he and Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves have to make a series of decisions that are all going to cost money. First up, we have public sector pay. We're now told that it's likely that the public sector pay review bodies for teachers and NHS staff will recommend rises of 5.5%. We've had kind of warm words about that figure from Rachel Reeves over the weekend, suggesting Labour might do that, but that'll be expensive. They've also got to sort out local government funding. They've told local councils they want to do multi-year settlements, which is fine, but they also have to stump up some cold hard cash. Otherwise, a lot of places are going to go bust. They've got these big compensation schemes, particularly infected blood, which I think hasn't actually been reflected in any of the OBR forecasts before because we haven't had a number for it. We're likely to get a number for it this time around, which means it has to be there in the forecast, and they have to definitely find money for that. And then, of course, they're under pressure to axe the two-child benefit cap, which is another expensive thing we're told they would like to do but may not have the money to. So all of those things will have to be paid for somehow. One option is they raise taxes, but the other thing I'm sure they're hoping for is the OBR gives them some more so-called fiscal headroom, right?
Yeah, and the OBR, the Office of Budget Responsibility, which does the fiscal projections that the Chancellor then has to work on for their first budget. And Rachel Reeves' this first budget is going to be this autumn. We're also expecting a spending review potentially at the same time, which will set out spending over the next few years. Again, we don't know exactly how many they'll go for.
They could just do
three.
They
could do 1 year, but they might end up doing three, not least because one of the other issues on the so-called shit list is council funding.
Yeah.
Cash-strapped councils have suffered probably... One of the sectors suffered the worst over austerity, in many cases losing about 50% of their budget over that 10-year period of austerity. One of the things they want most is multi-year funding settlements to have the stability to plan and to go forward. So those are the sorts of things that suggest it might have a longer-term spending review. But the OBR forecasts, this is one to watch, Kieran, because the government needs to give 10 weeks' notice to the fiscal watchdog, needs to press the button, and then 10 weeks later we can have the budget, and not before. And of course, Liz Truss did her emergency budget, a disastrous emergency budget, without those OBR forecasts. And that, if anything, was a perfect illustration as to why they needed to retain the fiscal credibility and confidence of the markets. So we'd expect probably that first budget to be sometime mid-October after party conference season, given the amount of time the OBR needs. But before then, Rachel Reeves has said that she's going to do this audit. Mm. Or the Treasury is going to do an audit to establish the sort of, you know, the true state of the public finances. Now, we've kind of been expecting this, haven't we? Even before the election, we thought it's likely that they would come in and try and say that things were worse than they had anticipated. And I think we all knew that the economic backdrop was pretty difficult, particularly with some of the Conservatives' projections, or the Conservatives' promises, I should say, that there was already going to be a fiscal gap of £20 billion, which was going to mean cuts, although none of them wanted to say it. And I think we will likely to hear back from Rachel Reeves in the Commons on the results of that audit before the Commons rises early next week. So that'll be a key moment for them, because there's all these things, all these challenges that you've mentioned, things like public sector pay, things like, you know, the NHS just desperately needing more money, council funding, the money for the infected blood scandal, and there's a whole host more. And so Rachel Reeves will have her first chance this side of the summer to stand up to the Commons and give us an idea of whether the government thinks it's going to have enough money to do those things. And that could be pivotal when it comes to how long this honeymoon lasts.
Absolutely. And so the key is, can they make the charge stick of things were worse than we were expecting? The IFS is out there saying that, look, we all knew how bad things were. We have the OBR forecasts. I think what Labour needs to do, and you saw this a little bit with the public sector pay, the way that was briefed out, it needs to show that the previous government had these forecasts but didn't let them go into the OBR forecasts. So knew how much the public sector pay review body was about to recommend. Mm-hmm. Same thing needs to happen, I suspect, on the infected blood scandal. And I wonder if there's a piece of paper somewhere in Whitehall with a number attached to that. In fact, I'm sure there must be, that Labour will then say, see, they knew how much it was going to cost and they didn't tell us. And that's the way I think they get the charge to stick. It will be slightly undermined by the fact that we've known for a long time that they're planning tax rises. So beyond what they've already announced.
And be clear, what sort of tax rises are you talking about?
We're talking about capital gains tax being an obvious one. We're talking about possible moves on inheritance tax. So they talked about not raising income tax, VAT, national insurance, but you know, there are other ways to raise money, and I suspect they will try and use some of those come that budget in October. So I think that, you know, you pointed out that we're looking at mid-October. I hadn't realised that is where we're at now in the calendar. You know, even if they mandate the OBR now, we're still looking at mid-October. So I wonder if that just becomes the defining moment of these early Labour years. Will they survive will their opinion rating survive after that?
And they're getting pressure, of course, internally as well. It's not just about what's happening, what the opposition, the Tory opposition and other parties can say about their economic plans. The one issue which has constantly raised its head throughout the campaign and now as well is the two-child benefit cap, which they are under a huge amount of pressure to lift from within their own party. And in response, we saw that child poverty strategy announced by Liz Kendall, the new Work and Pension Secretary, almost immediately on entering government. Interestingly, with a round table with a bunch of charities, all of whom think that the benefit cap should be lifted. And then today, we've seen this very nuanced, slight shift in position, presumably to head off this rebellion, which is mounting on the Labour benches, when Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson said that the government would consider scrapping the two-child benefit cap as one of a number of levers to lift children out of poverty. And then Keir Starmer, out and about around the country today, was asked about it and says that he agrees with everything his Education Secretary has said. Now, it would be very expensive, which is why they don't want to do it. Plus, they've sticking to the mantra of not doing anything that they've said that they've not committed to doing in the manifesto. But I think her words potentially pave the way for some sort of U-turn on that controversial policy. It'd be interesting to see, because that'd be the first, probably the first, potentially the first U-turn of a Labour government.
Well, to be fair, they have always said they want to. They just don't think they have the money to. So if they find the money, then I'm sure that
down the back of the sofa.
Yeah, exactly. That'll be top of their list. I think they're under huge pressure internally. And even though they would survive any vote on this, I think it would look pretty damaging, actually, if he had a few dozen MPs rebel this early into his premiership.
So that pressure, of course, is not coming internally. It's also coming from the benches opposite, despite the fact that the Conservative Party has currently got their, I guess, interim leader, you describe him, in Rishi Sunak. He's made it clear he's going to stand down. But we don't yet know when that interim leader, if it is indeed an interim leader or becomes the permanent one, will take over. What are you hearing about that, Kieran?
Everybody in the Tory party has been talking over the last few weeks about going long. They all seem to have slightly different explanations of what going long would mean. I think the shortest contest we can expect would be to have the final two ready for party conference in October, and then you do a kind of beauty contest, very similar from when David Cameron got the leadership, where you have two people who both give speeches on stage, then the membership takes a look at that and votes in the following week. So you have it wrapped up sometime late autumn, early winter. There's another scenario where you go until the end of the year. There's even a scenario, I think, that people are talking about where you go until April. So this could be an extremely long contest. For some reason that I haven't figured out, both the centrist faction within the Tories and the right-wingers seem to be briefing that a long contest will help them. I wonder whether people just haven't got their leadership bids quite ready yet, or they haven't got the money, or I don't know why everybody seems to think this is a good idea.
I think they're also a bit scarred, aren't they? Because the one thing we absolutely know about the election was that it was an almighty kick up the backside of the Conservative Party. Voters wanted them out. And even the most head in the sand type of conservative can see that the party needs to do a huge amount of work and probably quite a lot of introspection as well to work out how you even begin to build back from that if they want to stand a chance of retaking power in 5 years. But there are practical, there are logistical problems beyond their own campaigns and whether they're going to be able to be ready in time. There's also the fact that the Conservative Party centrally is running out of money and wouldn't be able to afford a longer contest, according to some sources. And then there's the competing power centres of the Conservative Party. There's the 1922 Committee of backbenchers, and there's the Conservative Party Board. And the 1922 Committee is absolutely split on whether they should go short or long. They had a meeting last week. They got another meeting this week about it. And they, of course, have primacy over the board when it comes to the process. But I think you're probably right in that there are a lot of people working out at the moment whether they could consider going for it. And I've got a quote for you, Kieran. I know you like these.
Go on then.
I'd like to see if you can tell me who this might be. Colleagues have been talking to me about it. I'm considering what I may or may not do. They then go on to say that there's a reasonable chance that they could run. Who do you think that is? Long pause.
Well, the obvious answer would be one of the front runners, so a kind of Kemi Badenoch or a Suella Braverman. You tend to trick me with these. I'm trying to think who...
It was somebody this morning, if that helps you.
Let's say it was... Priti Patel.
It wasn't. It was Mel Stride.
Mel Stride!
Who was one of Rishi Sunak's closest allies. And of course, you know, was on the morning round the whole time in the run-up to the general election because he was so loyal. He was one of the few that could be persuaded to come out. But I think the point is, you paused for a long time to think who it might be. You had quite a lot of options that you could have given us an answer to that. And I think it says quite something when even Mel Stride, you know, impressive politician though he is considering throwing his hat in the ring. This is potentially going to be a really broad race.
Bun fight, isn't it? To be fair, you know, nobody did more for that campaign during the campaign than Mel Stride, who was on our TVs and radio stations every single day. But I'd not heard of him, you know, desperately lobbying to try and position himself for leader before. You know, it's often the case that somebody comes forward that you weren't expecting. So maybe Mel Stride will be our David Cameron of this contest.
But it does feel as though they are potentially falling into the same trap that Labour did in 2010 when Harriet Harman took over as deputy leader. She was in place for the best part of 5 months. And in that time, David Cameron and his then Chancellor, George Osborne, used the opportunity to write the narrative, a narrative that then stuck. And the narrative was, of course, it was Labour's fault that the financial crash had happened. It was Gordon Brown's handling of the economy, really playing into fears that people had anyway. But it reached the point that Labour wasn't really, it took them years to shed responsibility, if you like, and for people to actually accept that actually it was a global financial crash. I remember George Osborne coming out after he'd left power saying, well, of course it wasn't all Labour's fault, it wasn't all Gordon Brown's fault, but they gave us an opportunity to set that narrative. And I think the danger the Tories find themselves in now is if they do go long, particularly if they go as long as April, which is the best part of 9 months away, they are going to find themselves very vulnerable to Labour telling everybody, my God, look at this mess we've inherited. Look, everything's broken. It's all their fault. It's hard to come back from that.
Also, I think that if it is going to go as long as this, I know we've talked about this before, but there's no way Rishi Sunak can continue. Because even during the King's Speech response, which he was widely praised for, Rishi Sunak, because it was very magnanimous, but you just saw this defeated man having to accept everything that the government was saying. And he really didn't offer much of a challenge on anything. And there was plenty that the Tories could have opposed in that King's speech. So I think they need somebody, even if they are going to go long, they need somebody who's at least going to provide a bit of resistance. You can't just have Rishi Sunak standing up and saying sorry every week for the next 9 months.
We'll hopefully find out more in the next few days what happens with the Conservative leadership contest and when it happens, crucially. But there's some other stuff to look out for before then, isn't there? Before MPs all have a well-deserved break. Well, before we have a well-deserved break, Kieran. So something I'm going to be looking out for is standards. Now, as you may know, if you followed my journalism, I've done an awful lot of stories focusing on the standards of the people that we elect to represent us. And Labour has made big promises on ethics, an independent ethics commission, on giving more powers to the Prime Minister's advisor, to changing some of the rules in the House of Commons about things like second jobs. And I'm going to be keeping a very close eye because I believe that we're going to hear a little bit more about that later this week.
OK, well, that'll be interesting. I'm going to be keeping an eye on where the party leaders are going on holiday. I haven't heard anything because we haven't had any stories about it. We all got completely sidetracked by the small matter of the election. And we've forgotten to write our Where Are the Leaders Going on Holiday
stories. Well, somebody who's close to Keir Starmer told me the other day that he's a complete workaholic and that it would be up to his wife, Vic, to kind of like prise his fingers away from his red box and take him away for a week in wherever he goes on his holidays. And it is really interesting. If you remember during the election campaign, that story about him clocking off at 6 p.m. on Fridays to spend time with his family and all of his defence then, I actually think, you know, rightly, was that people are better able to function, particularly in a high-pressure, intense job like being Prime Minister, if you have moments where you can switch off from it all, whether that's reading a book, whether that's playing football, whether that's hanging out with your kids, or whether that's pitching a tent in Wales and you know, spending some time with your family. So they'll definitely be encouraging him to take that break.
And do you think Rishi Sunak feels that he can finally take that break to California?
Yes, almost
certainly. That he's been planning for several weeks.
Santa Monica, here we come. How long he stays for, though, I think will be another question. So that's all from us today, and also all from us until September. We'll be back when Parliament sits again on Monday, the 2nd of September. Keep tuning in for Politics Weekly UK with John Harris every Thursday. This episode was produced by Eva Krisiak, music by Axel Cucoutier, and the executive producer is Nicole Jackson. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
This is The Guardian.